I'm pretty sure that my memory bank is approaching full. By that I mean I'm finding it a little more challenging to remember things as quickly as I once did. I'm, like, the information I know is still there, but sometimes it's just a little hard to place. It's a bit elusive. Now, to be fair, all through my life, I've been the guy who will walk into a room and then say when I arrive there, "Why am I here?" So, dodgy memory is not something that's new to me. In fact, well, I've always been really good at trivia, but then some certain fundamental things I've had trouble with. For example, I have had the experience of forgetting my mother's first name. That happened to me. I remember the first time it happened when I was in my 20s. So, I'm just finding, though, latterly it takes me a little longer to access some things in my memory. Things that I was previously quickly able to recall. Names are one of those things. My apologies around that. Where I placed my keys, and occasionally even where I placed my truck, just seem to not be there. Now, this is normally the point in the sermon where I would be tempted to make some sort of joke, some sort of forgetfulness joke, of which there is no shortage. Except I also know that this can be a rather tender subject for folks living in Qualicum Beach, where concerns about memory loss and worry about dementia are actually hardly rare, and truth be told, they can be immensely painful. While I have no small appreciation for those jokes, I also know that the loss of memory can be a terrible, terrible thing, and not actually especially funny. So I'm not going to go there this morning. But the simple fact that I'm not going to go there this morning, the seriousness of the subject, I think points to how memory is so important to us. Because memory helps us to know who we are. It helps provide us with identity. Without a memory, without a history, who are we? Furthermore, memory and knowing who we are and where we come from actually helps us navigate into the future. Which brings me to the subject of tradition. Now, that term, tradition, can mean a number of things. It can be used as a particular theological term. It refers to a source of authority beyond the scriptures. It can also be a type of a story related to something in the past, as a way of passing on information. It can refer to a style of things. It can be used in what I suspect is the most commonly understood way, which is kind of a reference to a form of cultural continuity, a way of connecting generations together through tradition. For the record, I rather like tradition and traditions. I find tradition and the familiarity that accompanies it, I find some elements of ritual, for example, I find them to be comforting. Because tradition moors me in what I otherwise find, at least at times, to be a rather confusing world. Hence I embrace some tradition with a degree of gusto. Particularly in relation to church and secular festivals. Now, I'm quite certain I'm not alone in this, but my family tends to do things in a certain way, at Thanksgiving and at Easter. And interestingly enough, I was thinking about this, Labor Day, not so much. It tends to pass without much fanfare, and I think that has something to do with my spouse's awareness that on Tuesday she has to be back teaching. So we just try to ignore it. But oh, do we ever get traditional at Christmas? Oh my, do we? We have only had to have done it once. And somehow it becomes, well, we've always done it this way. There's comfort and there's security in that kind of familiarity. Familiarity being a word I know which is rooted in the word family. Though we've found that there are accommodations that need to be made at Christmas as our children have formed relationships. And so some things, we've discovered, can't be kept the same as before. As our family's grown, things have had to shift. Our situation changes and our way of doing things just can't reasonably done in precisely the same way we've done it in the past. I was on a news website the week before last, and I followed some clickbait off to the side that promised to reveal to me the six greatest bad business decisions in recent history. And it was actually kind of interesting. And one of them was how 18 years ago, the video rental business Blockbuster was at the top of the food chain. Absolutely top of the food chain. It dominated the market of people wanting to watch a movie. It had something like 9,000 outlets just in the U.S. The founder of a new company that was streaming movies on the internet, some newfangled thing called Netflix. The founder of that company, Netflix, went to Blockbuster and offered to form a partnership with them. He was quite literally laughed out of the Blockbuster office. And now in 2018, Netflix is if not the dominant force in video. And Blockbuster declared bankruptcy less than a decade after that meeting that they didn't take seriously. I tell that story just to illustrate how time changes things. And sometimes you just have to adapt. You have to shift your way of doing things. And that can include some traditions. And that's one of the great challenges for the church today. It's one of the biggest challenges we in the church face. Because people quite literally think differently than they did even 50 years ago. But that's another sermon. Still, some of our traditions are head scratchers. We ran across one this summer when we were visiting our friends in the south of France. We had many meals of them sitting out in the warmth of the evening, and it was absolutely glorious. And there was a constant good-natured back and forth between us around attitudes and the ways we would do things in Provence and how we would do things in Western Canada. And one evening, Tevis and I were serving up something to eat, and she produced a cheese platter as an appetizer. Now, that's something we would commonly do in our home, and I wouldn't be surprised if many of you do the same thing. Carol's catching this one already. And I could readily spend the rest of the sermon ranting on about amazing French cheeses. They are wonderful. And I discovered one that is just to die for. It's called an époisse. I want to recommend it highly. And I will stop now because I could go on. Anyway, our friend actually declined to eat any, which seemed odd because this guy really loves cheese. I mean, seriously loves cheese. And so we asked why, and he said, well, look, we're in Provence. And when you're in Provence, and you have a main course, you always eat cheese afterwards. So, Tevis and I helped ourselves to the cheese, and he helped himself to another glass of wine. And sure enough, after the main course, he had then had a healthy portion of cheese. So, naturally, we mocked each other mercilessly. And we enjoyed some dueling, for lack of a better term, some dueling traditions. And, you know, traditions can bring life, I know that. Tradition can also be a burden. It can be majoring in minors, unless it's not a minor. And, of course, the trick is knowing the difference, right? In our gospel reading today, Mark shares a seemingly obscure episode where Jesus and the scribes and the Pharisees come into sharp conflict. They have a disagreement about the relationship between tradition and the law. And as we heard, Jesus doesn't seem to have much time for tradition, does he? Does he? Well, let's see. On first gloss, this passage seems to be a rather technical, intra-Jewish religious squabble. One we are well past, for we Canadian Christians are no longer living under the burden of the law. Well, that's not quite true, is it? I read somewhere, I ran across this a couple of months ago, that in the U.S., there are more than 100,000 federal laws. This is not counting state laws. More than 100,000 federal laws to be observed. Which I suppose is not surprising in a country that describes itself as a nation of laws. Okay, but we're in Canada. But you know, even if we only had a tenth of that number here in Canada, and I suspect we might not be far off their number, how do you live under that many laws? How can you even be aware of 10,000 laws? Never mind 100,000. And do remember that a general principle in Canadian law is that, quote, ignorance of the law by a person who commits an offense is not an excuse for committing that offense. I checked with my son. That's really what it says. On the other hand, nearly 200 years ago, the Lord Chief Justice of Britain noted this, and I quote, "No attorney is bound to know all the law. God forbid that it should be imagined that an attorney or a counsel or even a judge is bound to know all the law." How do you square that circle? Ignorance of the law is no defense, and yet you can't know all the laws. I checked this with Trudy just to make sure that I could use her as an example. But Trudy, our congregation's treasurer, she's a CPA, she's an accountant. And what she does is she helps people live under one small portion of Canadian law and regulation, tax law. And we need her and people like her because it's so complicated. Tax law is complicated. Laws, even simple laws, can become quite complicated as they get applied in different situations. The tax laws that apply to me are often interpreted differently for you because of your situation. In our country, for example, we're pretty clear that killing is against the law. And there's no getting around that. You kill someone in Canada, you have broken the law. That is unless the state says otherwise. And the state does say otherwise. The state has seen fit, and with no small reluctance, but the state has seen fit to permit killing in defense of the nation. That's why we have a military. Or to, in extreme circumstances, to allow police to use lethal force to protect. And we also now have legal medical assistance in speeding up the death of at least some people. So different circumstances seem to demand different interpretation, right? Well, that was no less true in Israel, particularly after the return from Babylon, where they spent half a century in exile. That was about 500 years, a little more than 500 years before the birth of Jesus. And Israel understood their exile to be a direct result of their unfaithfulness. And so what happened was some doubled down on not making a mess of it again. And one stream of thinking was that they needed to maintain purity. Maintain the purity of the nation in the face of the corrupting influences of the world all around them. And so they thought that keeping their eyes on the law more intentionally would achieve this. But keeping the law required some diligence. And so there arose this class of religious teachers and experts in the law. They were called scribes. And they offered wisdom on how to interpret the 613 laws God had given Israel in the different situations they encountered. They only had 613 laws, not like Canada, not like our tax law, not like our criminal code. Our laws are far more than 613. And so for some hundreds of years, these interpretations, these additional rules, they weren't written down. They were passed on orally from generation to generation. And then this new layer of interpretation, this new layer of laws, because that's what it became in reality, was called the tradition of the elders. And about 150 years before the birth of Jesus, this new group arose. They were called the Pharisees. And the Pharisees, well, Pharisee means separated ones. And the Pharisees emerged, and they were a sect who were especially concerned about purity and the influence of non-observant Jews and Gentiles, those who weren't Jewish. And so they were exacting, they were quite zealous in their adherence to the law, and yes, to the tradition of the elders, how the law was interpreted. And note that their intent was good. They were generally admired by the population for their commitment. In fact, years later, Saul, who was later known in the church as St. Paul, Paul would be such a person. In fact, if you read in Acts chapter 23, you will see how he spoke quite comfortably about being a Pharisee. He didn't say, "I was a Pharisee." He says, "I am a Pharisee." He was not embarrassed about that at all. He was quite proud of it. In our Bible reading, Mark tells us that the Pharisees and the scribes had noticed that some of Jesus' disciples weren't washing their hands before eating. Now, this is just good hygienic advice for any of us. Pay attention here, kids. But hygiene's not what they were really on about. Mark helpfully writes for his non-Jewish readers that this issue of hand washing was really ceremonial. It was an observance to maintain ritual purity, one of the, quote, traditions of the elders that was connected to the written food laws. It was about keeping kosher, abstaining from foods that faithful Jews were not supposed to eat. But even if the food was okay to eat, the tradition of the elders was that if you hadn't ritually washed your hands beforehand, when you touched that food, it was no longer pure. It now became unclean. Consequently, the Pharisees and the scribes come to Jesus and they complain that at least some of Jesus' disciples aren't following the tradition of the elders. To which Jesus quite undiplomatically and harshly responds, "You know, the prophet Isaiah was thinking precisely about frauds like you when he wrote." And then he quotes, he says, "These people make a big show of saying the right thing, but their hearts aren't in it. They act like they're worshiping me, but they don't really mean it." And then to prove his point, he shows how they were using their so-called tradition of the elders to avoid their financial obligations to their parents. Give money to the temple, you don't have to pay for your parents. Jesus was unrelenting here. He's in their face, he's lecturing them, and you can hear the sarcasm dripping as Jesus asks, "So how does that square up with the fifth commandment to honor your father and mother? What's the tradition of the elders got to say about that?" And then he turns to the crowd. My impression is he just brushes off the scribes and the Pharisees. He turns to the crowd and he says, "Listen up, this is really, really important. You need to know this. It's not what you swallow that pollutes your life." And then he gets actually rather graphic. He says, "It's what comes out of you, what you discharge." And because we're a family-friendly gathering, I'll give you the PG version. He says, "It's what you vomit up. That's what pollutes." Mark doesn't say what happened next, but I believe it's safe to say that there was a bit of a buzz in the crowd after he'd spoken. Mark does say that Jesus left the crowd and went to a house with the disciples where he began to unpack what had just happened. And he's quite clear. Jesus says it's really about what's already in us, not about externals. And he said to them that food merely goes into our stomachs and then out into the privy, out into the outhouse. That's actually the more accurate translation than our sensitive Bible translators massage a little. And Mark adds that in fact all foods are clean. A subject that will reappear in the middle of the book of Acts as Peter and Paul wrestle with the issue of how and why dietary laws apply to Gentiles now joining the church. This is massively important. It's a big moment in the development of the Christian church. And it's actually, the principle involved here is massively important for us today even. Because the problem's not food. It's the human heart. Our problems with purity are not external, they're internal, they're spiritual. And as we see in Jesus' own actions, eating with sinners, with the garden variety ones and the more spectacular and notorious ones, we see him associating with Gentiles. That conversation with a woman at the well, that was a big deal. That was a really big deal. I mean, this is a woman, and she's unaccompanied by a male member of her family. In that time and place, This was nothing short of shocking. We see in Jesus' actions that external purity is not really that pressing an issue for him. So no, the problem's not food. It's not what's on the outside of us. The problems are in us. And then he goes through that laundry list of stuff. Fornication, theft, murder, adultery, greed, wickedness, deceit, immorality, envy, slander, pride, folly. I know that list all too well. I know it by heart. And I expect you might too. See, that's what pollutes us. That's the purity problem. And it's going to take something different than hand washing to fix that difficulty. No, Jesus was not an opponent of tradition. He didn't reject it all, but he did want his people to understand what traditions were for and how they could bring life and how they could squelch life. And they can do both. In reality, Jesus understood the power of custom and tradition very, very well. He appreciated its place in our lives. He even initiated some traditions for his people to hold on to help them remember. To remember who they were, who we are, and who we belong to. His followers probably didn't know what he was talking about when he brought it up, because it was rather puzzling and mysterious. And to be frank, to me it's still rather puzzling, and the more I explore it, the more mysterious it seems. We heard something about it last Sunday when we reflected on the time that he said, most enigmatically, I am the bread of life. And then he followed up that statement by saying, only as you eat and drink flesh and blood, the flesh and blood of the Son of Man, do you have life within you. I mean, I really do wonder when his friends began to understand this. Was it at that gathering that Mark records some 7 chapters after today's? That gathering on the night before that he died when they were at the table? Was it while they were eating when he took a loaf of bread and after blessing it and breaking it and giving it to them, he said, take, this is my body. Or was it when he lifted the cup and gave thanks and passed the cup to them, and after all of them had drunk from it, he said, this is my blood of the covenant, which is poured out for many. Did they know that a new tradition had been given them? A tradition through which we remember him? Remember what he would do for the love of us all on the following day? Luke remembers Jesus saying, do this in remembrance of me. And so, yes, we do remember when we partake in this tradition. In this precious tradition, we remember God's new covenant with us, sealed in a most terrible and remarkable way on Golgotha. In this tradition, we remember our identity. We remember who we are. God's beloved people. A people filled with hope. A people with a future. A people redeemed and strengthened at this table. At this table. To live out the good news of Jesus Christ in a world desperate for the life that he brings. And painfully unaware that they even know need the life that he brings. This morning we once again participate in the tradition of our elder. The tradition of our elder brother, Jesus the Messiah. Eating and drinking at his table. And we say once again, thanks be to God. Amen.